Many thousands of people have given their time and energy to be part of projects like Galaxy Zoo, classifying galaxies in images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. But how is this translated into new scientific research? To find out, I met Dr. Karen Masters from the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation at the University of Portsmouth.
The Galaxy Zoo classifications, for me, at some level, are just another source of data on the galaxies. We do the same kind of data reduction that we do to the other data to the classifications. The beauty of Galaxy Zoo classifications for a scientist is you get multiple independent classifications of the morphology of a galaxy. So the spread in those answers, how well all the people who look at the galaxy agree on the morphology, gives you not only what the morphology most likely is, but a sense of how easy it was to tell that. So we kind of have morphologies with errors from Galaxy Zoo, which is very nice for scientists. Some of our critics say, we're going away from sort of the objective morphology that the field had moved to, trying to use computer algorithms to fit shapes, do complicated things like looking at where the isophotes shift and stuff like that. But I actually entirely disagree. I think our morphologies are very objective, and we do have these errors. Because we're asking citizen scientists to help us, and because they're so keen on the task, we get to ask 20, 30, sometimes even 40 people to classify each galaxy.
And what is the existing data that you're adding to?
I mostly work with the Galaxy Zoo, sort of the original Galaxy Zoo sample, which is galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So this was this massive survey run off a dedicated telescope in America. It's now surveyed, I think, something like 30% of the sky in very uniform optical bands, five colours, five filters. So we have that information, and we have spectra for every galaxy, which tell us not only the types of elements that are in the galaxy, but also the redshift of the galaxy. So we know physically where these galaxies are, we know what colours they have, we know how bright they are, so we can derive things like their masses, how many stars they have, stuff like that. I also like to fold in other data from other sources, so I've done stuff using radio telescope data, looking at fractions of that area. That's what I've been working on currently. In the radio, you can get at all sorts of different things. What I've been looking at is the signature of neutral hydrogen, which we call the fuel for future star formation. It's basically just gas that's left over from the Big Bang, and it will, we assume, eventually turn into stars or dissipate and become too diffuse to make stars. So all sorts of data from different big surveys. What's running right now at Galaxy Zoo is doing classifications for galaxies over half the age of the universe away. That's using data from the Hubble Space Telescope. And again, those are all public data, so as astronomers, anyone has access to the brightnesses, the colours and things like that.
And what are the questions that you're trying to answer in your research specifically? Yeah. What is it you're trying to get at?
Well, I'm very interested in how the different types of galaxies relate to each other and how, what's the difference between a spiral galaxy and an elliptical, and how that there might be sort of an evolutionary process between the two. I've done work looking at the unusual red spirals. So typically we see that spiral galaxies are blue, elliptical galaxies are red. Galaxy Zoo found this unusual class of very red spiral galaxies. So I've done quite a lot of work studying the properties of them, trying to see how they fit in to the picture of galaxy evolution. And one of the things we discovered was that these red spirals are much more likely to have a bar, this linear structure of stars across the centre of the galaxy. And some of them are quite spectacular. With Galaxy Zoo, we have information on which of these galaxies are more or less likely to have bars. And I've been looking at what types of galaxies are more or less likely to have bars. And it would seem that the bar is related to whatever process turns spirals red.
It must be difficult or perhaps impossible to tease apart the physics of star formation from understanding the history of galaxy formation. Mm-hmm. If you've got the spectrographic information, can we start to say something about the way that stars then relate to their galaxy?
Yeah, that's right. The spectra can tell you about what types of stars are in a galaxy. To first order, the light from a galaxy is just the light of all the stars in the galaxy added together. So even just the colours actually will tell you about the types of stars in a galaxy. Stars come in all different colours, but their colour is really strongly related to how massive they are. So very massive stars are very blue, very, very, very hot, and they burn very, very bright. And actually, they run out of fuel very, very quickly. So they only live for a very short time, astronomically. I mean, like millions of years. They live for a short time after they're born. Whereas lower mass stars are much dimmer. They kind of get swamped by the bright stars, but they're also much redder. But they last for really long times, like most of the age of the universe after they've formed. And so where you see a lot of blue stars, or where you see a blue galaxy, it means it's got some blue stars in it, which means it must have had star formation recently. Whereas if you see a red galaxy, it can't have any of those massive bright blue stars in it, so it can't have formed, or they have to be hidden, if we're going to be totally honest. They could be hidden in dust, that's the complication. But anyway, if they're not hidden in dust, it means they're not there, and so that galaxy can't be forming stars or can't have formed stars in the last few million years. And the spectra give you similar sorts of information, and a little bit more about what types of stars. There's little complications about when exactly, what sort of generation of stars you're in and things like that. And you can learn things about how often supernova must have gone off by looking at the ratios of different elements, because certain elements are only made in certain kinds of supernova and things.
We have what we call the main sequence of stars, and this is where we plot brightness versus mass, and we can see a clear demarcation in the types of stars and their colours and so on. Are we developing the same sort of thing for galaxies?
It's a little more complicated for galaxies, just because you've also got dust in there, and you've also got gas in there, and you've got other stuff going on. But there are people who work and spend a lot of time modelling the stellar populations in galaxies. It's a very important area of research, because we think that the mass of galaxies is very central to how they evolve. We think, or we know, that lower mass galaxies are typically spiral and typically are forming lots of stars today, whereas higher mass galaxies, especially the most massive galaxies, are almost exclusively elliptical and not forming stars. And the red spirals fit in here as being the massive end of the spirals. So I guess to some extent we are getting this idea, but those masses come from modelling. They come from modelling the light, from modelling the spectra, and sort of making an estimate of the types of stars and the numbers of different types of stars that make up that mass. So that modelling is very important science.
So given that modelling is so key, what extra data do we now need to get to refine these models and really make our image of the universe that bit better?
Well, what's really nice, actually, is to get an independent estimate of the mass of a galaxy. And we can do that by looking at how the stars in that galaxy or how the gas in that galaxy are moving. We call that the dynamical mass. And there's actually a move, I'm involved in a survey that's going to be called MANGA, which is another survey which is going to use the Sloan Digital Sky Survey Telescope. But instead of doing images, it's going to make what's called integral field unit maps of galaxies. So these are little maps of the spectra. So you have a spectra taken at lots of different points across a galaxy. So you can map out where the elements are, but you can also use the little tiny red shifts and blue shifts to map the kinematics of the galaxy. And so we'll get a map of the kinematics of thousands or tens of thousands, I believe, of these galaxies. And that will really fold in this extra dimension. And by comparing those dynamical masses from the rotation of the stars to the masses we estimate are in the stars from the population modelling, that really helps sort of tie things down. Of course, we always have dark matter complicating things, but we just have to deal with that.
One of the theories as to how galaxies grow is by essentially cannibalising other galaxies. This must put enormous sort of physical and gravitational pressures on them. So why, despite all that distortion, do we think that we end up with these easily identifiable structures in galaxies?
Well, we actually think that very major mergers that really disrupt things a lot, are not that common. It's been a little bit of a shift in the field from thinking that major mergers were the most important route for galaxy evolution. That's certainly how I learned it. But we're starting to shift away from that. We're not seeing very large fractions of merging galaxies. They're not increasing as much in the early universe as we thought they might. So we're starting, maybe some of these galaxies are quite isolated, or they're just having very minor mergers, very small things coming in, which don't really, they're just a tiny little perturbation. It's like a flea hitting you or something. It's not something that the big galaxy is noticing, although it is adding to its store of gas and its store of stars and things. We actually think that the bars in galaxies, it's possible they are triggered by these minor interactions, and there's some evidence for that, although it's still a bit unclear. So the fact that we see galaxies that sit there with very stable disks that don't seem to be doing much for a long time is sort of a constraint on how many of these big mergers can happen.
And now you have access to this army of citizen scientists.
Right.
What do you want them to do? What ideally, if you could get them all to look at one particular aspect, how do you want to use your army?
Well, I think one of the beautiful things about this universe is the variety of topics they have available now to citizen scientists. But I think the citizen scientists themselves have been very clear that they they'll take on all sorts of different tasks that are quite surprising, you know, looking at the light curves in Planet Hunters and drawing bubbles in the Milky Way Project, all sorts of different things that they enjoy doing. But the reason, or at least the message that we're getting as the scientists, is they like to do this because they want to help with science. So I think it's very important that we remember that the projects that we put out, we're not just putting them out there as sort of a fun thing to play with. I mean, they can also be a fun thing to play with for citizen scientists, but they have to be something that we want the answer for right now and that we really need help to get the answer for. So we think very carefully about what, you know, different projects need launching and what to ask. There is some new imaging from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that we're currently considering putting into Galaxy Zoo. So that could be exciting. We'll get, I think, 40% more galaxies again. So we've already got a large number of galaxies, so we have to think very carefully about what we're going to do with those 40% more galaxies.
Dr. Karen Masters from the University of Portsmouth.